So any questions about anything from last time? Or about anything? I wanted to say some more things about harmonic functions just for kicks, because it's beautiful math. And since we know the Poisson kernel, the formula for the solution to the Dirichlet problem, a lot of things pop right out from that. So I was about to prove the maximum principle for harmonic functions last time, and I figure I'd be a little bit more careful about it today. I need a little calculus lemma that's easy. I guess I need two of them. The easiest one is, let's call it one. Let's suppose we have a real valued function, and let's suppose it's continuous. So h of t, let's suppose it's greater or equal to zero, and it's continuous. On, say, an interval from A to B. Then you see people in freshman calculus make this mistake that the integral of a function is zero, it implies the function is zero. In this particular case, that's a fact. If it's not greater than or equal to zero, of course, you could have a sine that wiggles up and down, and you could have the area above be equal to the area below. So the integral being zero does not imply that the function is zero. But if the thing is always positive, or I should say non-negative, then the integral being zero implies the function's zero. And you can think of, if a function's only not zero at finitely many points and zero everywhere else, it is Riemann integrable, and its integral would be zero, but that doesn't imply the function is zero. But if it's continuous, then it does. And the little proof of that is just a picture proof. I think I've done it before. That if I had let's suppose the function was, let's suppose the integral is zero. If that h was not zero someplace, well, we might as well assume it's positive. Otherwise, replaced it by minus h. So if it had a positive value right here, let's call that t naught. If h of t naught was not zero, you might as well assume it's positive. And then I could take half that value, and continuity would keep me above this half value on a little thing of size delta. So here's, I'd take half that h of t naught, and then there'd be a little interval of size delta where I would get that the function is strictly above that dotted line. So that integral would have to be at least that much, that little rectangle right there. And that's a contradiction. So if the integral is zero, the function has to be zero. So we've used that before when we were studying Fourier series. So that's an easy one. And it follows from that, let's suppose that h is continuous, and we have, say, let's suppose we have it, h of t is less than or equal to m. Think of m as a max. And h continuous. Then if the integral is as big as it can be, it means the function's identically equal to m. So if the integral from a to b of h of t dt is as big as it can possibly be, that would be m times b minus a. Then h has to be identically equal to m. And you, the proof would be you just apply the previous result to... which one would be positive? M minus H would always be greater than or equal to zero.
So the proof would be... apply the first one to M minus H. Okay, so that little lemma. Another way to think about it is if you, I could prove it from this scratch. If I had a A and a B here, and here's my M, that's the max, think of that as a max, then this, that, that M times B minus A is the area of this rectangle. And if the area is that, it means that H has to always be up here. If it ever sunk down below that, I could get a contradiction by the same kind of thing I did there. If it ever sunk down and wasn't up to H, this little, I could get a little chunk of area that would get pulled out of that. It'd be, an area would be too small. So that's all there is to it. But so what I was proving at the end of last hour was the what I call the maximum principle. So the theorem. Let's suppose that we have U as harmonic on, say, the disk of radius 1 about 0, and we might as well make it continuous up to the boundary. On the closure. So that includes the circle of radius 1. The maximum principle was if U assumes its max M, say, at Z naught in the unit disk, so if that's an interior point, then U would be, have to identically be equal to that constant, the max, on the whole thing. That's the maximum principle in one of its forms. And so the proof was just going to be basically a picture proof. When you add that little lemma, to calculus lemma to it. So let's suppose the thing does attain a max. So here's the unit circle. Let's suppose it attains a max, how about right there? I know the averaging property for harmonic functions. It follows straight from the Poisson integral formula. The thing is one at the origin, when you're at the origin, so harmonic functions are equal to their average values over circles. Well, if it's a max here, I can put in a whole bunch of circles about here like this until I become tangent to the unit circle. Okay, so that looks pretty crummy. Sorry. This is supposed to be a circle about here. Yeah, that looks like a circle.
The value right here, which is the max, would be the average over this whole thing. And if the average of something that's less than or equal to m is equal to m, it has to be equal to m on this whole circle.
So we're going to assume that u of z naught equals the max.
Then we see that u has to be equal to m on the whole green circle by that calculus lemma, since it's continuous. And not only that green circle, but all the green circles centered at z naught.
Okay, so what I'm using is the lemma because u of z naught is 1 over 2 pi, integral from 0 to 2 pi, of u of z naught plus little radius, e to the it dt.
Those are those little circles I make of little radius r about z naught. And if those are all equal to m, this would be less than or equal to m times 2 pi divided by 2 pi. So those would all be
given by their maximum possible value. And the only way that could happen is that if u is always equal to m on that circle. So calculus lemma 2 implies u is identically to m on each of those little circles, on the green circles. Okay, so let's suppose the distance from z naught to the boundary is rho. So I'll make this little distance right here be rho. Well, then I see that it's constant and equal to m on this distance of, this would come out to be 2 rho now. So there's another rho. And now here, it's equal to the maximum right here on that spot. And I can do this whole thing again. So I go from 2 rho to a circle of 4 rho. So I repeat here. Okay, so I start out my z naught's distance rho, then I get a z naught that's distance 2 rho, and the next time I do it, I get a distance 4 rho. Eventually, I'm going to include the origin. So I get circles, get bigger and bigger circles. So the first circle has radius rho. The next one would have radius, let's see, then I went from radius rho. The next one would have radius 2 rho. The next one would have radius 4 rho. And eventually I'm going to get a big enough circle that contains the origin. And when I contain the origin, I can make those green circles fill up the whole thing. So rho, 2 rho, 4 rho, dot, dot, dot. Eventually, in fact, pretty quick, I get the origin in one of those circles. Inside a green circle. And now I have it achieving its max at the center. And so then the thing is done, because I can, if I have the center where it achieves the max, I can make those green circles fill out the whole circle. And I see that u is identically equal to m on the circle. And by continuity, it would be true all the way out. Okay, so that shows the maximum principle. Questions about that? That's kind of neat.
Can you say again why, like, when you move from your z naught to, like, the outside of the next circle?
M was the max on the whole disk. So I showed it's equal to max, it's equal to m on that whole green circle. And so now I have a new point. I can pick a new point in there, and I pick that one. It's equal to m on that spot, too.
Oh, okay.
And so that since that's the max, I see it's equal to m on this whole green circle. So it's equal to m right there. That's the biggest circle I can stick in there. And now I'm farther away from the boundary. I can repeat the thing with this being the new center. And I get a bigger circle. In fact, it would have radius 4 rho. I mean, it would have diameter 4 rho. It would have radius 2 rho. And I could keep doing that until I finally made it to the origin. And when I make it to the origin, then whammo, it's done. There's various ways of doing this. I like this because it's very concrete. But now a corollary of this theorem, I'll call this a corollary, The solution to the Dirichlet problem is unique. So the solution to the Dirichlet problem is unique.
Because if I had two of them...
So why? The proof, if I had two of them, two solutions, so I'd have a U1 and U2, they'd both be harmonic, and on the boundary, uj, I write it in complex notation, e to the I theta is a given function f, same function for both of them. If I take their difference now, they'd be zero on the boundary. U1 minus U2 is harmonic. On the disk, continuous up to the boundary, and identically zero on the circle.
Oh. I guess it's a corollary of the maximum principle that if the maximum has to occur, the maximum occurs on the boundary, right? Because if it occurs in the interior, the thing is constant. So there's two possibilities here. Either it occurs in the interior, in which case it's constant, and that constant would have to be zero, or it occurs in the boundary, and that means it's less than or equal to zero.
So it's equal to zero on the circle of radius 1 about zero. So here's a corollary of the maximum principle. I'll write it here, corollary of max principle. Harmonic functions attain their maximums on the boundary. Their maxes on the boundary.
Because if they attained it in the interior, then they'd be constant, and so they would also attain it on the boundary. And if they attain it on the boundary, they attain it on the boundary.
So that's the proof. So So we know that a continuous function attains its max. So the proof is, we know a continuous function on a compact set, a closed and bounded set, on D1 closure, that's a closed and bounded set, attains its max. That's an advanced calculus fact. And let's say it's at, Z naught. If Z naught's inside, then the maximum principle tells us that the thing is constant. The max principle
So the maximum, that means it's, that maximum is attained on the whole boundary.
So it's true that the maximum is attained on the boundary. So that would imply that U attains max on the boundary too, since it's constant.
And the second case, if Z naught's on the boundary, then
it also happens. So the next case, so if Z naught's in the boundary, then U attains its max on the boundary.
So in both cases, it happens.
Which means we can go back here and apply that. this u minus u2 would attain its max on the boundary. On the boundary, the thing is zero. So that means it's less than or equal to zero. So you would have that u minus u2 is less than or equal to the max on the boundary. But on the boundary, it's identically zero. So u1 minus u2 is less than or equal to zero, which means that, and I can do the same thing to u2 minus u1 and see that it's less than or equal to zero. So I would repeat, same for u2 minus u1. And we get that u2 is identically equal to u1, which shows the solution to the Dirichlet problem is unique. That's cool. Well, doing this little bit of work to solve the maximum principle, it's going to show us that functions that satisfy the averaging property have to be harmonic. So we'll call that a theorem. A continuous function that satisfies the averaging property must be harmonic. That's kind of cool. So the averaging property would mean the function is infinitely differentiable and is harmonic, satisfy the Laplace equation. And the proof is going to be no work for us now, because we know that anything that satisfies the averaging property satisfies the maximum principle. Okay, so here's the proof. Let's suppose that u is continuous on the closed unit disk. I can always shrink my disk if I want. So let's suppose u is continuous on the closed unit disk and satisfies the averaging property. And here's a fantastic trick. Let's let u twiddle be the Poisson extension that we get from the Poisson kernel. So let u twiddle of r e to the I theta be defined by the Poisson integral. That was the integral from 0 to 2 pi 1 minus r squared r e to the I theta minus e to the I psi this is my u, little u, e to the I psi d psi. We know this u twiddle thing is a harmonic function, and we know it has this for boundary values. So we know u twiddle is harmonic on the inside and continuous up to the closure. Continuous on the closed unit disk, and u twiddle of e to the I theta is given by these bounds. This is where I used to put the f of psi. And this, therefore, they agree. And now the fact is, the averaging property implied the max principle. So I've got u twiddle minus u. U twiddle is harmonic, so it satisfies the averaging property. This thing was given that it satisfies the averaging property. So there's two reasons for satisfying the averaging property here. This satisfies the averaging property. which implies the max principle. Therefore, this thing achieves its maximum on the boundary. But on the boundary, it's identically zero. So u twiddle minus u attains its max on the boundary. Which is the circle of radius 1 about 0. But it's 0 there. So what we've deduced is that u twiddle minus u is less than or equal to 0 on the whole disk.
Well, it was nice that there was no reason I should have taken u twiddle minus u. I could have taken u minus u twiddle.
So I repeat this whole thing. I repeat for u minus u twiddle. Same stuff. That satisfies the averaging property, and it's zero on the boundary. So I get that u minus u twiddle is less than or equal to zero. And so finally, I see that u is equal to u twiddle,
and u twiddle, being a Poisson integral, is harmonic. And that's how I see u as harmonic. It's equal to the Poisson integral of its boundary values. That's how easy it is. That's a cool argument. Everybody loves that. Questions about that? Since I have harmonic functions right now, I can't resist doing one more thing. There's a Liouville theorem for harmonic functions. So I can demonstrate that today. This is called Liouville's theorem for harmonic functions on R2.
And it says that if I have a function that's harmonic on the whole plane, and if it's bounded, if u is harmonic on R2 and bounded there, then it's got to be constant.
And this falls right out from the Poisson integral formula. Let me explain it. So the Poisson integral formula holds on any old disk.
So let's do it for a disk of radius R, about capital R, about Z naught. And let's pick a point in here. This point right here would be z naught plus little r e to the I theta. So that's a circle radius big R about z naught. The Poisson integral formula for that circle would be that u of z naught plus r e to the I theta equals 1 over 2 pi integral from 0 to 2 pi. The Poisson kernel, you can make a linear change of variables to change this to the unit disk. And linear change of variables preserve harmonic functions. And when you do that, you get this Poisson formula. R squared minus little r squared over R capital R squared minus 2R capital R cosine theta minus psi plus little r squared. And then we'd get u on the outer boundary, which would be u of z naught plus capital R e to the I psi d psi. That's the Poisson formula. And now here's the cool thing. Notice if the thing is bounded, then I would have this less than or equal to m, the bound. And so the trick is to differentiate under this integral sign and to take a partial derivative with respect to x. So let's see, I would take theta to be 0, and I would take x to be the x variable. So this would be z naught plus x. And I differentiate in the x direction. This would just be bounded by m, and when I do this, when I differentiate under the integral sign, I get something that's less than or equal to 1 over r. Okay, so here's what I would do. I would take r equal to x, theta equal to 0. That would differentiate in the x direction here. And I would find that du by dx at z naught would be equal to something. I would differentiate under the integral sign. I would get 1 over 2 pi integral from 0 to 2 pi d by dx of something. I'm not going to write it out because it's just calculus. And here I get u still on the boundary. And what's interesting when you do it is you find out that this is less than or equal to this is less than or equal to 1 over r. And this is less than or equal to the max, let's call the max m. And I'm integrating over a 2 pi interval length. So the 2 pi's cancel, and I see that this is less than or equal to m over r, where m is the max of the u. Okay, that's cool. And I didn't want to do this calculation, but it's just calculus. You just use the quotient rule and differentiate. And then when you stick in x equals 0, a whole bunch of stuff cancels out and it becomes very simple. So it's not hard, I just didn't want to do it. And you can do the same thing with the y direction. I would take r equal to y, and theta this time would be equal to pi over 2. That's going the vertical direction. So e to the I pi over 2 would be going in this direction, and if I multiply by y, I'd be going z naught up. And I repeat the same argument, and I would get that, I guess I should take absolute value here. When I do this, I would take the absolute value, and then I would put these absolute values inside, and that's what I would get. I repeat that argument above, and I get the same thing. I would get that du by dy at z naught is also less than or equal to m over r. The d psi, d theta is going from 0 to 2 pi, so the delta psi's are positive. I'm using inequality of integrals that the absolute value, or the modulus, of the integral is less than or equal to the integral of the absolute value. And so the d psi being positive delta psi can be outside. Okay, so now the proof, this is the big, this gives me the proof of Liouville's. If U is harmonic on the whole plane on R2, and absolute U is less than or equal to M on R2,
then the idea is pick any old point
in the plane. Pick Z naught in the plane, any old point. And then do this these inequalities. Those two inequalities, I'll call them 1 and 2. Let's see, this is this one was du dx at z naught. Let's call that, or maybe I'll call it A. And this one, call it B. Pick a big R. Let R be anything. Think big. It's a big R. Then A and B give me that the gradient of U at Z naught at the center is less than or equal to M over R.
The du by dx one is that, bounded by that, and the du by dy is that. And so that the length of that vector is less than or equal to M over R. And now the big idea is that R can be as big as I want. Now I can let R go to infinity, and I see that I squeeze this down smaller and smaller. It has to be zero.
We see that the gradient of U at Z naught must be zero. And z naught was arbitrary, so that means the gradient's identically zero. So the gradient of u is identically zero on the whole plane. And that implies that u is constant. Does everybody know how to see that? Maybe. So the reason why that would make u constant is that if I had a curve that started at A and went to B, and calculate grad u dot dx equals u of B minus u of A.
So if the gradient was always zero, this is basically the fundamental theorem of calculus for integrals in the plane. If the gradient was identically zero, then I could see that this is constant by connecting any two, I'd connect curves by lines. So this gamma from A to B would just be a line from A to B. And this would give me that U of B equals U at the starting point. So if I hold A fixed and let B slide around, I'd see that it's always constant.
So that's a Liouville's theorem.
And the funny thing about a Liouville's theorem is that's one way to prove the fundamental theorem of calculus.
And I think I'll prove the fundamental, what did I say?
Algebra.
So a very fun fact, which I think I'll spend some minutes in the beginning and next time, Liouville's theorem implies the fundamental theorem of algebra. In two steps.
I've only got 10 minutes left today, so I can't do it today. But
I need to talk about complex differentiable functions if I'm going to do this fun fact. So I'll define them today and I'll use them next time. They're called analytic functions. You notice in that in the beginning of Stein, he was treating z the way you used to treat x as a freshman calculus. If you look at a complex function like z squared, I can take a difference quotient. So let's write f of z equals z squared. Complex. Then I can take a difference quotient like you would in freshman calculus and write f of z minus f of a over z minus a. Let's see, that would be z squared minus a squared over z minus a. And in freshman calculus, you realize, aha, I can factor this top. And then the z minus a's cancel. And if I'm worried about making z minus a small as I let z slide into a, that takes care of that danger, because that dangerous part cancels out. And this becomes z plus a. And as I let z slide into a, this would tend to a plus a, which is 2a. So this would tend to a plus a equals 2a as z tends to a. That's what it means to be complex differentiable. But a fascinating thing is it feels just like I'm doing freshman calculus, but being complex differentiable is much stronger than being real differentiable, because this z can slide in from all possible directions. You know, when you're doing real variable calculus, you've got to slide along one direction only. This z can slide in from any old direction. And I just showed you that, yeah, some things have this property, that I can let z slide in to a from any old direction. This would go to 2a. So this would imply that z squared is complex differentiable. And f prime of z is equal to 2z, just like in freshman calculus. And so all those freshman calculus things for polynomials go through. And there's a quotient rule that goes through exactly as if you're doing freshman calculus. You write out the proof and it looks exactly the same as freshman calculus. The only thing is that z represents a complex number instead of a real number. And so you can show, so here's a definition. If f is complex differentiable on an open set, omega, we say f is analytic there. The French say holomorphic. German said analytic. So those words are interchangeable. So there has to be an open set, and f has to be complex differentiable on the open set to be analytic. And you can use these freshman calculus facts that you've seen. So here's a fact. Complex polynomials and complex rational functions, let's see, complex polynomials are analytic. And complex rational functions are analytic, where the denominator doesn't vanish. So complex rational functions are analytic where the denominator is not zero. And it's just freshman calculus. Everything you learn, the quotient rule, all that stuff goes through. And I showed you z squared was differentiable. It's easy to see that constants are differentiable. Their derivative is zero. Z is differentiable. Its derivative is one. I did z squared. And then you inductively get all the polynomials that way. And then you use the quotient rule to get rational functions.
And here's a fascinating another fact.
The real part and imaginary parts of complex differential functions are harmonic.
And in fact,
that's where harmonic functions come from.
So the real and imaginary parts. Of analytic functions. Are harmonic.
And that's going to allow me to use that Liouville theorem for harmonic functions to prove the fundamental theorem of algebra. I'm going to assume I have a polynomial that has no zeros. I'm going to take 1 over it. That's a complex rational thing. Its real and imaginary parts are harmonic. I'm going to show that it's a bounded harmonic function on R2 if it has no zeros, and then whammo, it's got to be constant. And that's going to be a contradiction, and that will imply the thing had to have zeros. That'll be fun. I'll do that next time. So once you have a Poisson formula, stuff like this just pops out without too much work. There was no delicate analysis. We just had that freshman calculus lemma, and it all fell out once you have the formulas.
Okay, let's see. That's enough for today, maybe. Any last-minute questions about anything?
You notice that my homework assignment for Monday is just 2 problems, but one of those things is what Stein calls a problem. I think his hints are sufficient to make it doable, but if you have any questions about it, Friday would be a good time to ask, and we can slow down and think about it a little bit.
Okay. That's it.
I do pretty much what the book does, but slightly in a slightly different order. So, if you've been reading the book, that's good to have done that. The emphasis will be more on what I did in my notes, because there's certain things I skipped in the book.
Right.
And I'm going to give you some practice problems. So, doing those would be a good way to get rid of it.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Sorry.
No, I posted solutions to the homework.
Going
over those solutions.
Okay.
R2
is the complex function.
Right.
What? I identify them. So x plus iy, I can think of that as z in the complex plane, or I can think of it as xy in R2.
Okay.
So you notice when I was talking about the unit disk, I was using complex notation.
Yeah.
Yeah, so R2 and C, for me, are the same.
Okay. Yeah, thank you.